article of Rav Dachovsky, and specifically the points that he considers that are of particular interest is that Rav Dachovsky, after going through essentially the same makoros that we've seen with the Meiri and the Reim and the Chekelev and others, and then to consider the question of what he was talking about, Rav Dachovsky, was about the viability of testimony that comes from recordings that were made clandestinely in the context of a divorce issue. So here he writes, just this is section Gimel, if you have it open in front of you. It's on page 48 from the magazine, or the PDF, it was page 4. So it says, Yeshurot Salomar, there are those who want to say, Shabain b'nei zog ein mokom ledaber hazon aseis chetzvada, that there's nothing to talk about if we're dealing with a married couple. Mishlam shnei zog kiskimu levata petoseim kolach kape b'nei zugo, because that's a part of the understanding of the marriage, that each one is willing to share their secrets with each other. V'af hischaivu b'tenoyim, and this is already established in the tenoyim. We mentioned last time it would be quite a nafkamina. If this was really connected to that, it would make quite a difference whether one has tenoyim nowadays or not, because there are those who do and those who don't, so we don't assume that it has huge ramifications, but it's interesting because this would be a significant one. V'al yavrichu v'al yalimu lo zemizu v'lo zemizah ki midura ba'avu v'chiba v'gam b'liksi v'stanayim v'farash, and even though right, it's not such a nafkamina, baru l'chara sh'shnei v'nei zog shonim v'pnei zarim. So we understand that spouses are different from strangers. So to that he writes, Ulam lefianiz daiti en hadvarim kain. However, I don't think this is really the case. Da'afshe b'nei zog, even though, yes, it's true that a married couple, men hastam, hiskimu levater achelet mikritei seyim la'achra achasana, that to a certain extent, they are agreeing to a greater degree of openness after the marriage. Mikomakom zerak min hastam. That is only under default circumstances. When everything is good and there is love and affection that is found in their house. But let's say if one of them decides he no longer wants to be so open, that should be his right. And even when they are happy to be shalom with each other, v'chi ain't chumin, what, there's no limits, so chalkei chumin, or partial limits, shebehem kolach v'mnei zog mo'unya lahamshich lishma al petosav, where someone's going to say, I still want my privacy, v'ma shehebi ra'yi milashna tenoim ha'ksuba, and the idea that you can bring a proof in the language of the tenoim, yishlomar d'zehu l'gabai hanachasim v'shar n'yani ma'amun v'lvad, you can say it's only talking about monetary issues. If you want to say it really means not going to hide anything from each other. So that, our Gemara talks about the notion of kinyan dvarim, if something is just basically a deal that you will do something, and the kinyan should not be chal. Zach? I thought you were raising your hand. Okay, so what do you think of this? How does this whole strike you, this whole issue? Do you think there is a difference with a married couple? Or do you think Rav Dachovsky's position, do you find that more compelling? Or do you find Rav Shenkolovsky's position more compelling? And what about this idea that it could shift in the middle? Do you have any thoughts about this? Do you think that one position makes more sense to you? Yeah, Max?
I mean, I'm not necessarily sure which position or what, but I feel like the concept of positions shifting mid-marriage has some overlap in conversations that we've had about Chazaka, related to whether or not people want to have their secrets at all times kept, or perhaps we can just treat secrets as always available to be kept secrets.
Well, you see, it's interesting because it's hard to take a side on this, and I think that probably, practically speaking, Rav Dachovsky's position is a much bigger chiddush, so I think it would be harder to rely on. And also, for a lot of reasons, it would be harder to rely on. But I also am not even sure how securely he's saying it, or how confidently he's saying it. But it's interesting because the question, theoretically, say theoretically, because I just said that it'd be hard to act based on this, I think, either lechatchila or b'diavad, but certainly lechatchila. It doesn't seem like it's good advice for a practical situation in a marriage. But there's a couple of points that are being opened up by the discussion theoretically, which are interesting to focus on for a moment. So first of all, just the idea that the marriage relationship itself presumes a certain closeness, which maybe should change the rules as far as what the expectations are. And that itself is an important question to focus on. What makes something different here? Is it because of expectations? You just understand that this is just not a environment in which you have full confidentiality? Or is it because that was actually a commitment? So to say it was a commitment, so that's a chiddush, again, reading the Tanoim that way, or to say that it's implied in the whole marriage relationship, certainly a chiddush. But it's an interesting question, so then could that change in the middle? Or is it because it was initially committed to, so then that still maintains, even if one side decides it's not interested anymore, as long as the marriage is still going on. And just, again, this is so hard to conclude in any definitive way, but it's just interesting to throw out some issues here. So, Max, what you noted before, the whole question of Mechila by Hezekiah, I think this is different than Mechila. And it's just worth appreciating that and pondering it, because when we said before that there may not really be a place for mechila or for a binding mechila in the context of Hezekiah, if it's a personal suffering, if we viewed it as anguish to the individual, then mechila wouldn't work in a way that you could be held to. So that means that, okay, if two people who normally have the rights of privacy from each other, and one decides, look, I don't care, so later on he might decide he does care, and that's something that we should be able to validate. But here it's not about that, what he's suggesting, whether you accept it or not, but what the suggestion is that the nature of the relationship changes what the expectations are. And therefore, it's not subject to the feelings of the moment. It goes to the nature of the marriage relationship. Which could become very difficult if there is a lack of harmony between them, because that's really going to create issues. But that seems to be where he's coming from, which is just interesting to consider its implications. And also a part of it, and this would also come up as a defense in a situation like this, again, whether one accepts it or not, it's that one party can say to the other, or might say to the other, that you're not entitled to full privacy because your life is too intermingled with mine. So it's one thing to say, if we are completely separate from each other, but we happen to live in proximity, okay, so you have your private life, I have my private life. Even though there too, it's not totally the case, and that's something that we see throughout the Masechta, that in a shared space, we do have an impact on each other, and that's part of the broader picture. But certainly a married couple is intertwined with each other, and that also becomes a part of the premise, that you can't say that I have no interest in what you're doing, because by its very nature, it affects me. So how much did that play a role? It's interesting to speculate. Yaron?
What exactly is the case you're speaking about? Because I'd say can you make a chiluk between, let's say, like husband and wife, like have a reasonable expectation that maybe things will be more open? Like, is it reasonable for them to expect that their spouse will record them?
No, it isn't.
I feel
right.
Like that there's...
Yeah, no, it isn't. It certainly isn't, which is also why part of why I wouldn't say l'chachila, and I think this is not... It's not healthy behavior, although by definition it's talking about a situation that's already gone pretty far past what would be expected. But the premise that Rav Dachovsky is suggesting is that maybe you don't have the right to your secrets the same way two complete strangers do. And how much should that affect things? How much should that change the balance? Al?
Well, it seemed like at that point, like clearly things have changed.
Right.
But the secret recording device itself is supposed to be secret.
Right. As I said, it's clearly again, it's clearly not healthy behavior, not recommended behavior. But what I'm more interested in is just extracting from it what kind of principles. So yes, things have changed, but was if the premise was mechila, right? So then, like what Max brought up before, is to make it say, okay, but listen, that was expressed when they were all on the same page. No, they're not on the same page. It seems quite glaringly obvious that there is no longer any agreement of mechila. However, it could be, I don't think he was saying that it ever was based on mechila per se. He was saying that it's understood that entering into this certain relationship means a certain amount of mutual interdependence. And when that's the case, so then the ability to maintain a completely separate life is less present. And therefore, you have to understand, it's not about mechila. But I think that's the point. It's not about mechila. And that's why that would be the answer to Rav Shankalovsky's objection that, well, they don't want to be open anymore. So he'll say they don't want to be open, but it affects me. And therefore, I have conflicting interests in terms of the desire to have absolute privacy here. So, Zach, then now?
In the imagination that it, you know, is part of the entering into the relationship, I said, like, I'm mochel on my rights under the ketubah or under the tanayim. Would that change the situation at all? Because I can imagine that maybe the entire situation isn't subject to, but the reason why we know in your relationship is you signed, you know, some documents saying that you're in this relationship. So, like, how would those documents affect the whole situation?
I don't think it affects it that much, because, you know, he's referring just to a phrase in the Tanayim, which he also goes on to say wouldn't actually depend on your literally signing the Tanayim, even though he mentioned it before.
Yeah, but you literally signed, okay, so the Tanayim is, but you literally signed the Ketubah.
Right,
so.
But the Ketubah is not where it comes from. And the Ketubah, that's more about obligations to each other. But the focus and the language of the Tanayim, I think he means more is what it reveals rather than what it commits. And just that whole language is there to highlight the fact that the relationship is meant to have a certain degree of openness, and therefore that compromises the confidentiality that one might want. Now, clearly it becomes very tense when indeed they are at war with each other and they are planning on expressing conflicting interests, and therefore they're going to want to have more confidentiality. So the specifics of this are highly complex, but it's just interesting to see what is behind this argument. Okay, so he then goes on to say a couple of interesting points in this article. He then goes on to note that, to quote again Rav Dechavsky, who was premising that if there is a danger of suffering at the hands of the other party, so then that could allow secret listening, based on Rav Chaim Pelagius Chuvas, that he allowed the opening of letters in a situation where you're afraid that there's something being plotted against you. And he explains this based on the premise of Avid Inish Dilma Nafshe. It's a sugi that Gemara has in a few places. That theoretically, and here again you have to emphasize theoretically, because the conditions to allow this are very limited, which is a part of what he'll address here, but that under certain limited conditions, a person is allowed to take steps to protect his own interests, specifically when there's no hope of recourse through Beis Din. V'zol gam hasiba, this is now an os dalid, shemutir lasos keno naslam noah me'adam la'avar iser, and that's also why one could take steps like this to prevent someone from violating an iser. So he comments about this, yesh lahayir, that even the chikei lev has complicated calculations about what applies when as far as allowing this. And he goes on also to note that vaday shem yeshnav, this is the important part, shem yeshnav ados shechaver onmed lahaziko. So if you know a person is definitely going to hurt you in a substantial way, so then, Rishoy Adam Linkor Becholem Tzoyim Ha'omdim L'Rishu Som Nasim L'Sanezek. So then, yes, you can take various steps to prevent somebody from literally hurting you. And then, Lo Rak L'Hazim B'Sei, so it wouldn't just be about listening to him. Ela Af L'Hakos Es Omid L'Haziko. You could even hit somebody who's trying to physically hurt you. And that's not just midin avid inish, that's midin ganav abal machteres, like the halacha of the Torah describes somebody breaking into your house. Even at the price of actual lethal force. Ulam kolzeh kashem edubar alvados nezek. Right? So here are the percentages and the likelihoods play a role, which is a part of what we emphasize there. It says, if we're talking about where there's definitely going to be harm. Och shash nezek baramas severus gavoa biyoser. There's a really high chance of somebody actually hurting you in a pretty definite way. Ulam kashi yesh barach shash bovav nezek oligar. I mean, there's only a little bit of a concern for some damage that could come up. Lo shamanu shamotel adam lasos din asno ki agato. We never heard that you're allowed to take justice into your own hands in such a case. Right? And even when a person sees that his property is in somebody else's hands, you still cannot just take action into your own hands. You have to be able to prove it. It's in the Dalit. And you have to have evidence that you really have a very high ability to prove that this is what's going on. Okay, so he goes on to talk about these points in detail. When you can and when you can't. And just how practical are these points. Okay, and he concludes that section saying, okay, Nirish ein lahatir hazana seser el manaslam no nezg makrim shiyeshna sviros gavoa biyosa shahalu alu hazik lo v'shali day hazana zu yuchal limno es hazik. You really have to know with tremendous confidence and probably ability to prove that somebody is really actively trying to hurt you and that this listening is going to make the difference. So then he considers the question, which Rav Dechavsky also talked about, is there a difference between before the fact and after the fact? Is there a difference before allowing you to do it and its viability as testimony in court? So here he writes, Nirish Yavol Ishtamish Bimeida Shahusag Aideh Hazana Seser. If somebody is going to use information that he got through listening, who Allah Misperi Surim, so that itself creates possibility of violating many surim. Shaul Shalomi Das is basically taking something without permission. Gazel, Gnevas Zuchuyas Yotrim, intellectual property theft. Rechilus, and the idea that they're basically partaking in Lashon Hara, when he writes Mamish, below Akavat Rechilus, literal Rechilus, and one has to be very careful not to do this. Then he talks about what a potential onus would be. And then he has a little bit more here about the credibility in court. And then, in the very last paragraph, to go back to what Rav Zilberstein spoke about, so what if you have two people who are talking, and one person knows, they both know that the others are there, and the question of recording a conversation without saying that that's what you're doing. So if you recall, this was the second of the two discussions in Rav Zilberstein, where we noted that he had similar calculations as far as comparing that to bugging somebody's phone or listening in a conversation that you're not a party to. And we emphasize that even if the same factors are in both questions, but the degree is very different because it's far more intrusive to be listening into a conversation that you're not a part of than it is to be recording a conversation you are a part of. So to this he quotes the Chukei Lev. And he writes, "Tva'od nir lefin is daiti lomar." It seems to me that afilu shalech adam migars to chavero. Even if somebody is sending a letter to his friend, asu lechavero shavalu migars. So the recipient of the letter is not permitted legalos divrei migars lacherim. Is not permitted to reveal the content of the letter to others. Da afilu b'stam v'leka shum sod. Even if it's just default. And there is no secret in it, but over Meguna, there's a loss of davar gruta. There's no secret or anything that's embarrassing. V'nezek l'hakos v'igaris. There's no damage to the one who wrote the letter. None of those things. Still, it's legal. It's still not permitted to reveal the contents of the letter that you received to someone else. Why not? Because the Gemara Yom we saw Kolmer Devil Chaveru Bal Timer at Shiomer Lo Befer Shiomer. If someone tells you something, you have a default of you shouldn't be repeating it. So the Kol Shekain Deikignai Osod Viotzei Nezek Kshmulei. Or for sure, if it is embarrassing or there is some kind of disgraceful information or some harm that could come out if you reveal it. Ayin the Razal Varashi Lachma Aleph. Excuse me. Sorry. Okay, quotes plus to back that up. Yim came le daito. So therefore, after according to the Chikei Leib, Reb Chaim Pelagi, after makapel haygaris einu rishai laharosa laacherim lo rishus kosva. Then even the recipient is not allowed to show it to somebody else without their permission. V'af sheyada hakosei. Then even though the one who wrote it knew sheyitachin sha makapel yira laacherim, that the one who received it will show it to others. Mekom makom samach al kach shelo yira. Right, this is something we discussed, right? So even though you know that you are exposing yourself to vulnerability, that when you put something in writing, there is always the chance that the other party could choose to share it. But nonetheless, you trusted the person not to. He's not going to show it to other people. Therefore, he's not permitted. Okay, very interesting stuff. All right, any questions about that before we move on? Any final points? Okay, so then let's move on to the other issues. So now in terms of Re'ia, not Shmia, but the practicalities of Hezek Re'ia and how they reflect the three issues that we've talked about, the problem of interfering with somebody else's ability to function because they're being seen, and the psychic pain they could feel by being spied upon, as well as the moral standard of privacy. So how does this play out in some of the details that we see practically speaking? So one interesting point just to start with, that there is discussed in the Tur and the Shulchan Aruch that if you have two neighbors who have a chatzer in between them, so really our Mishnah, our first Mishnah, is telling us there should be a wall. So what would happen if they simply can't afford it? What if it's a poor neighborhood and nobody who lives in this neighborhood can afford it? What should the din be? You have two neighbors who want to have a wall, but even between the two of them, they can't afford it. Yeah?
Maybe you build as much of the wall as you can, even if it doesn't fully protect from Hezekiah, protect from something.
It would make sense, but let's say you can't build anything. So it says in the Torah, I don't think I got this on your list, I apologize. Take a look. It says in the Torah in Kufim and Zion that one is going to have to do the best they can. So the Torah says if they can take from tzedakah to build the wall, so then they should do that. And if not, they have no recourse. There's no money between them and there's no tzedakah that's being provided. So then they have to be as careful as they can to respect each other's privacy, to not be looking in on what the other is doing. Which, clearly, we had a whole premise in our Mishnah that that's pretty much impossible. And that's why we don't believe you when you say, oh, don't worry, I'm going to look down the whole time. But rather, we require a wall. But at least if the wall just can't happen, so then, that's what the Torah brings, that you should either take from tzedakah or do the best they can to not be seeing each other. So in the Ramah, he actually just brings The second possibility doesn't mention the tzedakah. And the question is, why not? The Smar raises the question, why not? They don't necessarily have such a good answer. But in terms of this idea of tzedakah, so the Aruch HaShulchan talks about it, and it's very interesting. The Aruch HaShulchan notes that the idea that you can take from tzedakah in order to do this, in order to build this wall, it's not because of the notion of tzedakah for mitzvos, to the extent that exists or doesn't exist. It's not just because there is a mitzvah that you have to have a wall, so if you can't do it, you'll have to ask for tzedakah in order to fulfill that mitzvah. But it's because this is understood to be a basic human need. And the same way, shelter overall is a function connected to tzedakah, and so many other basic human needs, food and clothing, are all justly included in the tzedakah rubric. So too, the wall is in that category too. When you say that you need clothing and food and a house, you also need a wall between neighbors, and therefore tzedakah should be permitted in order to provide for that. Shmuel?
The wall is a basic human need, or like there's like privacy?
Privacy is a basic human need. So the assumption here being that being forced to live below the communal standard of privacy is a basic human problem. And therefore, just like stock can be used to pay for your food or your clothing, it should be able to be justly used here as well. Zach?
Now that communal standard was mentioned, I mean, I have a question in terms of, is this obviously a greater sugya and tzedakah?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how much are you allowed to take to build your wall? Like, is it, you know, is it like the minimum of the Mishnah? Is it Hotzi and Vidafna? You know, or if the communal standard is to build very thick walls,
right. That's a good question.
But I know it's a general sugya and tzedakah in general.
Yeah, and that's something actually the later part of Parak is going to get involved in. But it would seem, just on the surface, no pun intended, that here it should be the standard. Now, they may not, it's a strong possibility, they may not get that amount of tzedakah, and then they probably have to suffice with less. Right? Same way, the question is, what if they had enough money just to buy a cheaper wall between the two of them? They had no access to tzedakah, and the minig is a bigger wall, but they only have money for the cheaper wall. So then, presumably, that's what they would have to do. So that should be true as well if the whole thing is from tzedakah. Okay. Yes, sir?
Seeing this is a basic human necessity, then mm-hmm. it should go by menah. Wouldn't menah require taking tzedakah for the chiyuv?
So the minig would define the chiyuv. And that you also see in other contexts as well. That, so for example, when we talk about the mitzvah of tzedakah, and the Torah in Parshas Re'eh defines the mitzvah as dei machsoro, you should be there to provide for that which is lacking. So the Gemara emerges, there are different levels of what constitutes dei machsoro. So one of them is the real fundamental human requirements. So if a person can't eat, can't sleep anywhere, has no clothes, so that would qualify for de machzoru. But there's an additional level also where if a person is at such a distance from what everyone in that community is doing, is so far from the communal standard, so then there's de machzoru to that as well. So it would seem here too, there's a combination of factors here, but that if that's what the minig is in order to create the wall between two parties, so that should probably be like that here also.
The reason why you go call them in on dinner isn't necessarily for that reason, because that dinner wall is going to be so much lower standard, it's just because Chazal and Rishakin, because they wanted to have the same thing.
Yeah, but they wanted to have the same thing because it does reflect a certain standard. So the assumption is that we could theoretically put these on a scale and and find a standard.
Isn't that the more practical issue, so they're not arguing about it?
Maybe, but that also, but that still creates the reality that each one is entitled to the protection of the wall as defined by that society. So presumably that should factor in here also. Okay, so with that just in mind, so let's talk a little bit about the whole notion of windows that face each other. And what about a matter of degree? Right, so we saw in the Gemara in the third parak in Cheska Sabbatim that there are all kinds of requirements as far as one who would open a window, meaning literally open up a window, create a new window in his house that would face somebody else's window. So if through the window he's able to see into somebody else's window, so that creates a problem of hezekriya. And that's something we would tell this window dude not to do. So the question is, what could change that? What about, for example, if there was a certain degree of exposure to begin with? So you saw from those Gemaras over there in the Tesim Beis and Samach Amar Aleph that what if there is a Rosh Hasharabim in between the two windows? So there are people who are walking around out there. So maybe the one who wants to open up the window can respond to his objecting neighbor that how could you tell me that I'm causing you problems because I can see into your house and now you have to conceal yourself if you want to do anything private. But that was true already, right? Because there's a Rosh Hasharabim outside your window. So it was already true that you had to be aware of how you were behaving. Right, this was actually a theme in past week's parsha, right, with the whole idea of Yitzchak being visible at the time when he was with his wife, and the whole issue of what was going on there and how he was being seen. So the notion that when you're able to be seen by others, you have to act in a more discreet fashion. So that was always true. So what did you see, if you saw the Makaris today, what did you see that the Rishonim debate regarding that concept? Right? This notion that, well, you have to worry about the Rosh Hasharabim anyway. So where did you see Rishonim maybe taking different stands on things? Mm-hmm. And what was their question? What was their issue?
Does it apply above the first level?
Okay, so what's going on there? Right, the Rashbam brings up that if you have people traveling in the streets in between, so then they're able to see inside, so they can perceive what's going on. And that's not just true about the street level, it's also true about the, at least a little bit higher than that, because if you have somebody who's riding a horse, so then they're going to be boosted up and they'll see more than what an average height person will see. So how does that factor into things? Right, so according to the Rashbam, right, so if you want to open up a window on a much higher floor, so then your neighbor has the right to say, don't do that. And on the higher floors, I'm not exposed. On the lower floors, I have to be careful because there are Rosh Hasharabim to see what I'm doing. But I have other rooms up on a higher floor. So there's no Rosh Hasharabim visibility. So I can stop you from opening a window on the higher floor. But what's the main disparity among the Rishonim? Well, what about, let's say, the second floor? What about a little bit above human height? If you have a horse, so a horse will lift up people, and maybe they could see into the second floor as well. So you have some of the Rishonim, like the Rashbam and the Rush, Tosfos Rid and others, who say that, so therefore, second floor also, the neighbor cannot object because he was already vulnerable to the horses. But some, such as the Ramban and the Rashba in his Chuvas and in his commentary, so they disagree. So what's going on between those two opinions? Zach?
Well, the Ramban quotes the Gemara back on Bava and Bet.
Mm-hmm. What did that Gemara say?
Which basically says the guy across from you drop him can, you know, he has all these claims against you. You know, well, there, the Shuta Rabban people are there during the day, but you're at night. Or,
right, let's say I have two people who share a roof.
Yeah.
And so one person wants to, so what they need to do is they need to have some kind of a divider between them on the roof. That's what the Gemara discusses there. Mm-hmm. And that's true even though they're visible to the public. So why? If I already could be seen from the public, so why is it that I can stop you from being up on the roof with me without some kind of a divider? Right? So what's the, what are the positions there? And so there, the Gemara says that the person on the roof can say that, yes, it's true that the people in Rosh Hashanah Rabban can see me, but there's a big difference in degree, meaning that even though I am visible sometimes, but the difference in degree that you bring to the equation by being up here on the roof with me is very significant. So here, the Ramban is referring to this Gemara on Vav Amud Beis. Right in the middle of Vav Amud Beis, where the Gemara says that you have this issue, whether it's in a private setting, you have to have this division on the roof. The Gemara says, Bein Bershus HaYachad, Bein Bershus HaRabim, whether there are others around or there aren't others around. And the Gemara wants to know, why do we have to emphasize Rosh Hashanah Rabban as well? So says the Gemara here, it's towards the quarter of the page down, above the Beis, that it's Trichle, because we need that case also of Rosh Hashanah Rabban, because Mao de Tema, you could have thought, so Neimele, the other guy can say, Sof Sof, Habois Let's Nuyem, Ibnei Rosh Hashanah Rabban, that you already have to be discreet and careful, because there are people out there in the Rosh Hashanah Rabban who can see you. So, Kamash Malan, so what we see from here is the Amalei Rabbi, the person can respond, Rabban b'yamam achazuli b'lil yolochazuli. That the people who are out there in public, so they're only out there during the daytime, they can see me at night, they can't. At bein biyama bein belilya chazizli, but you'll be able to see me all day and all night, and that's not so good. Or inami rabim ki kiimna chazulach. So the people outside, if I stand up on my roof, they'll be able to see me. So ki asivna lo chazili, but I'm sitting, you can't see. At chazislei bein chika amina bein ki asivna, you'll be able to see me either way. You'll be able to see me whether I'm sitting or standing. And rabim ki me'ainu chazile. And the rabim here is also especially interesting, that if they try to look, it's okay, they'll be able to see. Ki lo me'ainu lo chazile. So they're not going to see me if they're not trying. At memeila nami chazile. You are going to see me as a default. You're going to see me on automatic, and therefore I have a right to complain that that is significantly different from the fact that I theoretically could be seen by the public. So that suggests that there's a great nuance that when there is hezekriya and when there isn't, because normally you should say that if a person is already in a situation of visibility, so already they have to be discreet, so then I'm not causing any problems by expanding this. But we see that at least for some metrics, it's not true. That for some metrics, if I am really creating a different reality for you, so for example, the first one is especially significant, right? To say that, all right, I have my nighttime to myself because the people could only see during the daytime. So that certainly takes things onto a whole other plane when I say I have no privacy even at nighttime. But also the other considerations that I could sit down and I could maintain some privacy from the public, but if I sit down now with this kind of proximity, it's not going to help. And also the fact that they have to be looking carefully in order to be able to see me. All three of these things are probably relevant in terms of trying to assess the question. It's not simply that they're vulnerable that right away that creates the prohibition, but it's also that this is being exploited, that or this is creates a whole different set of facts that also makes things different. Yes, sir.
The first one answer seems so powerful. Why is it?
Yeah, why do you do the others?
Yeah,
because that would certainly be the most, right? A person, you know, could, because there it goes from a person having a certain amount of privacy, you know, at least his nights are quiet, so he has to go from there to having 0% of the day private. So one would think, like you're saying, that's already very significant enough. That should cover everything. It's a great question. But it does just highlight how much these variable nuances can make a difference. Zach?
Just to answer Sam, I think the yes, the night issue is important, but most people aren't active at night. So, yes, I'm subject to a higher level of, let's say, you being able to see me even at night, but it's not total, because at some point you're going to go to sleep too, and you're not going to be active, and I'm going to get my privacy anyway. It just might be, you know, at midnight as opposed to at 7 p.m.
And therefore, what would you do with that
part? And therefore, it's not a complete claim, right? I could say, okay, you have your hours, you just have a few less hours.
Because you're addressing the question of, you know, that should really just be glaring. You know, here, if you're putting somebody under constant surveillance, so it should be obvious that that's going to be a problem. Mm-hmm. So I think, if I understand you correctly as to what you're saying, that, no, because still not constant. But it is still significantly different. That's enough. Right, the fact that there is this whole significant aspect that you're adding into this by having that kind of exposure is significantly different. Well,
I mean, because like I think they also like just with like general like security things, like they say you don't actually need to be watching, you just need to be able to be watching to create the same effect of uncomfortability or whatever.
So you're saying that you
like what do you say? It doesn't. They don't. You don't need to know that the person's watching. You just to be uncomfortable. You just need to know that the person
right,
can watch whenever.
Person could be watching.
Then yeah. Just go straight to the last claim in the Gemara, which is you know the other people they have to specifically be paying attention. You are always looking. So that's really the best claim in the Gemara. Is just that you know. You no matter what, you know, you look out your window, I automatically see Sam, you know. So
okay. Well taken. So on this specific issue that the Rishonim debate over here about the window when they're Shosarabim, so they note that this whole difference basically the second floor, so all the Rishonim would agree that on an upper floor where there was no visibility from the public, so that creates issues. And they would also agree that on the floor level where there's a lot of impact of the public, so that means that the owner already has to be pretty careful there. And if I was opening a window that created that kind of access, I wouldn't necessarily be changing anything in a significant way. But the question is, how do you view the horseback riders who give a little bit more height to the situation? So that second floor is the middle ground here. Should we say that the second floor is essentially already vulnerable? Or no, there's a big difference between being vulnerable occasionally to a horseback rider who may pass by at any moment, or to the public that are there all the time, and therefore that's enough to create a significant difference. Now, the Rambam's language, he just has it across the board. He saw that Rambam says, Hareini kimivnei rishus harabim shuraina sach, that your neighbor can say, I am just like your public, your adoring fans, who can see you, and therefore I am not doing anything worse to you. But in the Shulchan Aruch, he brings the Rambam's language. But there, the Shulchan Aruch does mention this four amos measurement, which is essentially about the first floor, and apparently not extending it to the second floor. Okay, so far so good? Okay, so here on this Mishnah, it's also important to note that as far as the practicalities of what we see nowadays, now we don't see necessarily so much objection and so much zehirus as far as the placement of the windows. So the Tosfos Yontif writes in his commentary to here to the third parakah of Bava Basra, in that sugya in Chezkas Abatim, that whatever people are used to and they're okay with, so that's going to be okay. And he does understand it as an implicit mechila. If people are used to something, so then that means they have basically accepted it and they're okay with it. Now, it's interesting because we have seen that when talking about the law, in the first Mishnah in that context, that according to many Rishonim, such as the Rash, quoting in the Shulchan Aruch, that when talking about the wall, Mechila doesn't help. Right? And a minig, so to speak, to not have a wall at all between two neighbors is not going to help. And here we're going to say that if the windows are consistent with just what people are okay with in this neighborhood, so then the windows are okay, but not having the wall that the Mishnah talks about would not be okay. So what's the difference between the two? Any thought? So there is the factor, some of the Mefarshim explain, the reason that we won't let you get away with no wall, even if you're both okay with it, even if you're mochel each other, is because we say, or let's say, even if the minig is like that, right, even if the minig is to have no wall at all, so we won't let you survive with no wall. So that, as the Sma explains, that's because of the situation of Bari Hezekah. That it's clear there's going to be this damage. That two people living in complete exposure to each other, they're going to have a problem of being able to see in. It's Bari Hezekah. It's for sure there. But apparently with the windows, not on the same level. That's not called Bari Hezekah. In the Sefer Minchas Tzvi, which is a contemporary Sefer in Halchas Shcheinim, so he discusses along similar lines, where he makes that point also, that there's a difference between what is really clearly going to cause a problem and that which is somewhat more up in the air as far as these expectations are concerned. But Mechetzvi also notes that Lamais, let's say somebody wants to build a building outside in a field where there are neighbors who object and say that they'll be able to see into their houses. So he writes that, first of all, nowadays the custom seems to be that if it's far enough away, so then that should help. And there is a big difference. He mentions 8 meters there. But there is a big difference between a window that's literally up against the neighbor or really can create access and one that is farther away. And he also notes that nowadays, as the law has it, that all the windows should be built with movable shades. So if somebody is in his house and he wants to engage in some private behavior, so then, okay, it's up to him to pull down the shades and to activate the trisim, as they call them. And that should be enough to permit this kind of construction. And that's where he draws this distinction, that it's not like what the Rosh was talking about allowing mechila or minig to say you don't need a wall. If you don't have a wall, that is bari hazeka. That's for sure causing a problem. But here, if the minig has become to allow this kind of window placement, so then that's more possible for the minig to come in to define, because that's not going to be bari hazeka. Okay, I think it was Zach and Shmuel.
So then could we force everybody halachically to buy shades?
Well, yes, he was saying that they, for the law, forces everybody to buy shades.
So even without the law, if
right? So you know, it's not the existing takana, but it's not that you could force them stam, but it would solve problems. So you know, and presumably, if that's a minig or if that's a takana sachanin of takana of the leaders of the tzibor in a certain place, so then that should be something they could do. But here he's mentioning it not so much as something that by itself has to happen, but that if it does express itself as a reality, if it is there as a given, so then that has the advantage of being able to forestall some other hezekriya situations. I think we're smaller than your own.
When the Tosfos Yontif talks about an implicit mechila,
the minik being
the mimic. So like if the person decided, I'm being explicit that I don't want this, it doesn't matter because like that's what everyone else does. Like, it's not like your personal mechilas.
Yeah, it would seem like it, but I guess there's got to be a gvul. You know, we'd have to really know whether this was actually consistent with what all the buildings are like, or is a person, the other party in building Maisie, being unreasonable. So, because clearly the default is that there is the right of the other person to object. The default, that's what our Mishnah, the Mishnah of the Third Parak and the Gemaras are talking about, that there is the right of the other person to say, no, you're not allowed to open a window opposite me. But when there's enough distance, so then that should, if that's what all the houses do, if that's the minig there, so then the victim, so to speak, if you want to call them that, should have to understand that, okay, this person is acting in keeping with local standards, and it's not fair really to object to that. Now, it's also interesting because of the Pesachei Tshuva notes that here, the idea that we have that if you move things up to another degree, so that creates issues. So the Pesachei Tshuva notes that even if you already have a window, and the window is gas, is glass, right, so that window is glass. So glass can actually make a difference on two levels. So first of all, Avkas Rochel was the author of the Shulchan Aruch, and he is quoted by Pesachei Tshuva and others as saying that if you have a problem with Hezek Ria, so sometimes having a glass window instead of just an empty space helps. So you're probably wondering, well, how does glass help? You can see through it. So what does that do to prevent the hezek ria? So what's the answer? How does having glass help? Yeah?
Does it protect from Hezek Shmia?
So no, because we've seen Hezek Shmia is not necessarily a consideration under normal situations. So, first off, you have to know a little bit the history. So when the author of the Shulchan Aruch says that glass helps, so as the Pesachei Tshuva and others note, probably wasn't talking about our glass. That it was glass that was much more foggy and was very difficult to see through, so it was kind of like tinted or frosted glass just by its nature. And therefore, that does make a big difference. That does perhaps create a real interruption. However, as later Svarim point out, that, as Pesachei Tshuva discusses, that it could be that even our glass still is not the same as a fully open window. Because the Pesachei Tshuva quotes an opinion that if somebody had a glass window that was firmly in place, and now he wants to put it on a hinge so that he'll be able to open the window fully, which you couldn't do beforehand, that constitutes upping the game as far as Hezekri is concerned. Even though until now he had a glass window, he could see out of the glass window. But as far as right, there's still a big difference between having this hinge and letting the window fly open, because then once the window's open, people can stick their heads out and look around a little bit. So he assumes that in addition to this question of what the Zechuchas was, even if Zechuchas was clear, there's still a difference if a house has a clear window that is kind of blocked off. I mean, it has a foggy window that is blocked off, so then that would not be the same as, well, it's two things. Well, if it has a foggy window or if it has a clear window, but it's set in place, and he can't stick his head out, that to change that situation would constitute an upping of the threat of Hezekiah. Yaron?
Yeah, so what about, if we're talking about, like, looking into someone else's window, what about a case where you have a window but it, like, overlooks into someone's yard or, like, their outside area where they can't put a shade up, let's say?
Yes, that's a bigger problem.
Or, like, they have trees, but, like, you put it on top of the trees, so now you have, like,
Yeah, so then they would really have a good case. If now, by building this window, I can see into your property, so it wasn't the case before, so then that creates an obligation on your end. Now, that itself is interesting in a lot of different ways. But that's true also. So in terms of the limits of Mechila, just to note, the Shulchan Aruch Harav writes that when you have these windows opposite each other, so he says, even if one party or both parties are a Meichel, so it's not enough, because of the third reasoning of Bilam and Matovo Halacha, that it's not just that you have the right not to be seen by somebody's window, but that you have the responsibility not to be seen, that that's a part of proper moral behavior. So we were just discussing that Minig could be relevant in establishing what you have to do. So here again, you see this difference. That basically what he's saying is that the protection from prying eyes, so that should be there whether you want it or not, because that is a proper approach. But when the local custom is not to consider a certain placement to be intrusive, so then that minig is still going to be valid. They could both be true. Right, so if you remember when we first started talking about the takana of the wall, so we said that there are a number of sugyas that are all going to interconnect. If you recall, we talked about mechila and minig and chazaka all as flowing from one point. But here it could be there's a difference that minig is effective, but mechila is not effective. So why would that be? Because mechila means that even if it's bilateral mechila, we're both mocha, but it means that we are abandoning the status, the state of snias that we're supposed to have. But if it's not considered to be intrusive in the first place, because that's the minig, so then that might have more of a role. And that perhaps could make a difference. Okay, so we'll have to pause there, and maybe we'll say a little bit more about this tomorrow and move on to some other practical issues. But this is all very fascinating stuff. What it highlights is that even though Hezekriya is, to a certain extent, about the impact I have on you and how much you're compromised, so even if you're still already compromised, so we see here that it's not so simple for me to say, well, you're already compromised, what am I doing wrong? That there are matters of degree. And that also becomes very significant when we talk about preventing the kind of Hezekriya that we are concerned with. Okay, any questions about any of that? All right, it's fun stuff. So just to quickly recall what we talked about, so we talked a little bit about Shapovalovitz's article about, Shapovalovitz's article about listening into other people's conversations and recording them, and his various points of disagreement with Rav Tychowski. And then we talked about neighbors that can't afford a wall, that they should do whatever they can not to see each other, but maybe even take from tzedakah. We talked about Derech HaShulchan, that taking from tzedakah is not because of the mitzvah component, but the reflection this is a basic human need. And then we talked about what happens when you're going to open a window and the other party has the right to object, but there's some degree of Hezekriya anyway. How much does that factor in? So we talked about second floor windows where horse riders could see in, even if they're few and far between. And then we talked about various other questions, such as Mechila, probably not so helpful here, and that's interesting. But on the other hand, Minig and Chazaka maybe a little bit more relevant. And essentially to consider how all these various points come together. Okay, sound good?